everyone. Welcome back to Huron County Author Talk, a podcast where a group of talented local authors share their insights on the remarkable, imaginative, and nuanced world of writing. I'm your host, Hamilton Baker of the Huron County Library, and I'm excited to bring you another episode in our show. So whether you're a fan, an aspiring author, or a reader interested in hearing more about this creative process, this show is for you. In this episode, I sat down with one of Huron County's local authors, David Yates, at the Huron County Museum. In our interview, David tells me what it's been like to write about Huron County history for the past 16 years. He talks about his love of writing, his research process, the value of writing, and more. Enjoy. How many books have you written up to this point?
Well, I've written 5 books up to this point. 4 in the one series on Huron County that takes Huron County history from 10,000 BC to 2017. And 4 in that series, and I've written a book on Admiral Bayfield, who, as you know, surveyed the Great Lakes and was actually in Huron County along the lakeshore in the early part of the 19th century.
Yeah, we did that. You did a talk on that book last year.
That's right.
Two years ago.
Yeah, not that probably long. Last year. Yeah, probably not that long. Mm-hmm. And I've written over 700 articles for the local papers.
I was going to ask that next, was how many articles do you think you've written? It's over 700.
Yeah, I don't have an exact figure, but it's over 700 at this point.
How many years have you been doing that?
Actually, about 16 years now.
Okay.
Started off, a former editor of the paper asked if I'd be interested in doing something on local history. I was a little bit interested in local history. Mm-hmm. And strangely, I was more interested in international affairs, international politics, what's happening in the world, but local history is pretty interesting too. Mm-hmm. And I kind of dived right in because I remember saying to the editor, I said, well, what do you do after 6 months? Because I thought of Huron County as cows, plows, and Tiger Dunlop. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, give it a try. So I did. And what I mean, even now, I never would have thought 16 years later I'd still be writing a column for the local paper on different topics. And I've gotten far more out of it than I ever thought I ever would. Like, I really kind of enjoy kind of looking at the minutiae of what goes on in your neighborhood. And there, and Huron County has such a rich history on both on land, air, and sea. We've got it all going on here. So I really enjoyed doing that, and I was asked to do it, and it was a snow day, and then it became almost like I was waiting for my teenage kids to come home on Friday and Saturday night. So I can't sleep if I didn't know where the kids were at night. So this gave me something instead of watching the late show or something like that. It gave me something to do in the wee hours in the morning waiting for the kids to come in when they were teenagers. I've kept at it, and it's been great, and you'll never run out of material to write about.
I was going to say, I would also have been skeptical, I guess, that I can write, that you could find that much for that long. But like you say, there's something, it's just endlessly. There's just more stories you can always uncover.
Yeah, when you think about, well, there's European civilization in Huron County started in 1827, and then, I mean, there's a whole wealth of information that unexplored information on, like, the native peoples that lived in the area. And but even in the last 200 years, there's so much. Like, when you look at a building or a church or the society and how we've changed, like the social organizations that were so important at one time, like fraternities and churches, and what denomination you belong to was, or what political party you belong to, defined your character, defined who you are, and you picked your social circle based on those sorts of things. And it's really interesting. The other thing I'm kind of really interested in is what we celebrated at one time. Mm-hmm. The events, what we thought was important, and it's really interesting how we've changed, and in some ways how we've stayed the same. Right. In a lot of ways, I'd say that they were more interesting than we are today, And researchers looking at today are going to find it a lot more difficult than I found it looking at people like that lived 100 years ago. So it's been really good. And I used to like, even as a little kid, I remember in grade 2, writing these great big long scrolls on my own time on Davy Crockett at the Alamo or something like that. And I used to really like to write. And there was a period where when I was in high school and university, I thought writing was the worst thing you could ever do because you had to grind out the term essays and that sort of thing. And then I thought, when you get old, you kind of go back to like writing stuff down. Like I used to encourage students to keep a journal, a weekly journal of things. And now I've kind of realized later in life than say you that I kind of like to write. I kind of like think, this is kind of pretty good, and I look forward to sitting down doing the research. I like doing the research, and I like thinking about different ways to present information in an interesting manner or try to communicate it in an interesting manner. So as I said, my journey in local history has been rich and rewarding, and I am so glad that I did it. But 16 years ago, when I started doing the first story or two, I never would have dreamed I'd still be doing it.
No. It's really interesting, actually, that whole process, that whole journey you went through to 16 years. Wow. All your books are about history, and you taught history as a teacher, as I know, since I was one of your students.
Yeah, a very good student.
Yeah, try to be.
Yeah.
When and why did you take an interest in history?
Well, I can't pinpoint a time, but I can pinpoint. I was, in a lot of ways, I know I was kind of raised by my grandparents and great grandparents, or at least I spent an awful lot of time with my great people born in the 1880s. I was born in 1962, and people born in the 1880s, I spent a lot of time with. I was kind of immersed in that. And my grandmother was a librarian, and all the discarded books that she thought I'd be interested in, she'd bring home, and I'd like flipping through them. And there are some books I remember really, really well where you'd stare at the pictures over and over again or whatever. And it's probably not politically correct today, but I was given boxes of toy soldiers to play with. And that was the best thing ever because you could sit in the backyard and play in a sandbox. You could play in the backyard and you could set them up, and then you become interested in the armies, the history of the armies and that sort of thing. And I still have a collection of old toy soldiers.
From when you were a kid?
Yeah, from when I was a kid. I kept them in their little boxes, Airfix, big ones, little ones, the G.I. Joe. I was in that generation that played with the G.I. Joe I think it was 12 inches, the original. I don't have any of that stuff, but that's the stuff that's valuable.
Right, it is.
Yeah, people collect that. Mm-hmm. I just missed out on Star Wars. My brother had the Millennium Falcon and all that. But so I've always had an interest in history, and I can't explain where it came from. I mean, it was just innate, but I kind of credit my grandparents and great-grandparents with instilling me with a love of learning, a love of books, and I just naturally gravitated towards history.
Sounds like, yeah, like you say, it's because you spent so much time with people from
an earlier century that were in the 1880s, and I still tell my, and one of the things that's so important too is that oral history, that family tradition, knowing your grandparents. Because I remember my great-grandmother telling me stories from the 1880s when she was in school, 1880s and 90s, and I'm trying to communicate. She communicated stories to me from her dad that was even earlier, and I'm trying to pass that lore down to my kids, so maybe they'll talk about people that lived and their family, like stories, anecdotes from people like almost 200 years ago we're getting up to now.
Right. Yeah,
and I hope they would keep that going.
Because it's very interesting.
Well, they were really interesting people. And my great-grandfather was a blacksmith on the railroad, and that's why he lived so long, because he had these great big he like when I was a kid I thought he was huge, but I realized he wasn't that big, but he was built out here like this, and he had all this scarring on his forearms and all that stuff from being. And I remember he still did his blacksmithing and his metalwork he had a forge, or I call it a forge, it probably wasn't, but at the cottage, and he used to do it in London, and he used to be really good at fixing anything.
Right.
That didn't transfer to me. I'm not handy at all.
Oh, no.
No, no, not at all. I wish I was. I wish I had those metallurgical skills or whatever he had, but he was good at everything. Like when it came to a hammer and whatever.
Hands-on stuff like that.
Hands-on stuff, yeah. Yeah. So I really always enjoyed history. And it was kind of just in my blood, and I was very fortunate that I got a job. Well, it wasn't even a job. I got to stand up and talk about history all day, as you know.
Yeah, yeah.
As you know. And I got paid to do that and had lots of holiday time. So I had, I was really, really lucky. I was really, really blessed that I was able to do something I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the kids enjoyed it some days as much as I did, but I did. And so I really... I really feel like I've been kind of blessed because I could do my stories now, and I taught for over 30 years, and it was great. And as I said, I was really lucky to teach something that I really liked.
Yeah, that's great.
It wasn't even a job.
Right.
I don't want to, but you know, I don't really feel like I work too hard.
No.
No, I don't really, I didn't, it wasn't like really work.
Right. You know, you enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, I did, and I don't feel that I didn't feel like I was working. If you had a good idea for a class lesson or something, it wasn't really work putting it together.
Right. Just came naturally to you.
Well, it was just kind of fun to kind of do or something like that. So I don't want to disparage any of my teacher colleagues that spend, you know, burn the midnight oil, you know, doing lesson plans and marking and report cards and all that stuff, but I never felt I was really working really hard. I really liked what I did, and I enjoyed the kids. So I was really, really lucky. Had my down, like you have your ups and downs like any 30-year period, but the ups were really, really good.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it was. I was really, really lucky.
Which book was your favorite to write?
Well, you see, that's like, which is your favorite kit?
So maybe there isn't one.
Yeah, well, there isn't. They're all kind of like unique. And when you're putting together like what goes into each book, you kind of think, okay, you got to do the select. You can't include everything. And so you try to say, okay, what are the most interesting, or what are the ones that I got the best feedback, like stories or areas that I got the best feedback from? And sometimes I wrote stuff that I was more interested in than I think the general reader might be interested in. But a lot of the stuff, another way of putting that, what type of history do you like writing the most or something like that? And when I'm writing stories, I kind of like the true crime. Maybe it's a morbid fascination, but I kind of like the true crime ones. Sports heroes. The military history has always kind of like been an interest of mine. And I'm developing an interest in like arts and entertainment type history, like we talked about just before we went on about like the dance pavilions. Mm-hmm. And how many people really, you really like it when somebody comes up and he says, oh, I remember that, or I remember going there, or I remember when we did this, like I said, the social history. Mm-hmm. And there was a time when on Friday and Saturday night, everyone went out to a dance. There was a dance going on somewhere, and there was live entertainment, and everybody liked the dancing, and everybody liked to go out, and they remember those as being some of the good times. And somebody just told me the other day that they met their future husband at the dance pavilion in St. Joseph. And so you kind of really like the social history type stuff too. And whenever you get a good social history type thing that involves lots of people or that people remember, and it brings back nostalgia, and I kind of like writing about that sort of thing too. But I do like, it's a morbid fascination. I kind of think a really neat one-act play would be about when the hangman came to Goderich. They gave him an assumed name, Mr. Ellis or Mr. English. He came three times. And I thought, wouldn't that be interesting to tell the story, coming to Goderich through the hangman's perspective or something like that? And Like I said, that's kind of a morbid fascination I have, but the true crime is kind of interesting. Try not to write any true crime stories that are less than 50 years. It's too close.
Yeah.
The history isn't even about the past. In fact, it's not even past, because sometimes you write something, you think, okay, this happened 100 years ago, and you'll get a phone call from somebody who is a descendant of somebody in there, and which I find really, really interesting. The story I didn't think anybody knew about is lurking in a lot of families, and so you got to be very aware of that too. You can't, you know,
like you said, it's not the past for those people.
It's not really even in the past, and as I said, we're all history is always lurking around, the good and the bad, you know what I mean? It's always just under the surface, but it's important to kind of know that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, history isn't just about the generals and the battles and the prime ministers and kings. It's about how people live every day.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So that's part of your books. Like, that's part of what you're trying to do is communicate that to people.
Yeah, you try to put together something like, what was life like for people living, say, in 1950 or 1920, and you try to, as much as possible, I try to, and it's hard to do that sometimes, but I try to capture kind of like a feel for the age, and sometimes that's one of the weaknesses of modern nonfiction, is that sometimes when I'm reading a book, it's 21st century people with 21st century values commenting on how people in the 19th century thought. And I can't remember if it was D.H. Lawrence, or he was a novelist, and he said, the past is a different country. They do things differently there. And they do. They think differently. And for us to be so... or sometimes they're writing, like, they try to put 21st century ideas or values in the 19th century
setting,
and it doesn't work. And there's an... See, sometimes when I'm reading a book, there's an authenticity about it. This kind of feels for the era. And then sometimes you read a book and you think, oh, this isn't... The Victorians wouldn't have done that. The Victorians wouldn't have said that.
It's too modern, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's too modern. It's like, yeah, I think that's what makes them more interesting, is you go back and try to look at the world through their eyes. Like, we really did export a lot of good people out of here, or influential, not all of them were good, but influential people, and we did, you know, I mean, I'm amazed at how plugged in Huron County was to the rest of the continent when we had the railways in here. Like, people are hopping, I'm amazed at how mobile people were. People hopping on trains and boats and going to Chicago and Detroit for the weekend, or whether and coming back. And I said, we don't even do that now.
No, not technically.
No, not to, like, that's a big, but people are always, like, they're coming and going on trains the boats. Like, we had the Greyhound, and for the biggest thing for 20 years, the biggest event in the season was the trip to Detroit on the Greyhound. They used to take hundreds of people from Huron County once a year. They used to bring the, usually June, they'd bring the people in to stay at the Sunset Hotel, and they'd stay here for the summer season, the Greyhound would, and then the Greyhound would take hundreds of people, would buy a ticket, and they'd spend, I think it was like 4 days and three nights in Detroit. It was a package deal. And it was Detroit in the 20s when it was at its height, like the auto industry. And you got to see all this live entertainment and all that stuff. And people remember that for generations. And before that's lost, you try to capture that in the story or something like that. You know?
All right. What inspired you to write that first book?
Well, actually, I kind of had the idea that at some point I wouldn't mind putting together some of these stories in a collection or a book. But a really good friend of mine called me up, and Colleen McGuire, and she said, would you be interested in putting together some stories in the book? And she even lined up the Ontario Genealogical, the local branch of the Ontario Genealogical Society, the OGS, and said, we'll pay for the book. They even paid for the second book, which I'm really, really grateful for, because I don't think it wasn't for Colleen, I would have actually I thought, yeah, let's do this. But if it wasn't for her, I don't know if I would have bothered to put them in book form. And even then, and I realized, holy cow, there's a lot of stuff here. Like, with over 700 stories. I mean, I've only got a fraction of them in book form.
Right.
And so look for more of those books coming out. But that's what. But I always kind of, even before that, like I always kind of thought I'd like to write a book of some sort. And or you know, and I always kind of had that in the back of your mind. But a lot of people see, a lot of people that want to write books. There's a lot of people that want to write a book and probably be really good writers and authors. But you just got to sit down and discipline yourself to do that. And I wasn't sure if I had that type of discipline or if I thought, God, that sounds awfully intimidating, right? Like a 250 or 300 page book. Don't you think that sounds intimidating?
Yeah, it takes a lot of work.
It takes a lot of work, and you have to have, because I know you're, yeah, like you like to write, and you're working on something, but you have to have kind of like you have to want to do it, and you have to enjoy doing it, and you have to kind of enjoy working, well, because it's such a personal thing. Mm-hmm. As you know, you put so much of yourself into whatever you're working on. You know, and even though it's not about, the story's not about me, it's kind of like me out there, you're putting out there, and so, you know, even when you started to put, like, I started putting those stories, I thought, what do people think? And see, I can't read anything once it's in the paper. Once I hit send, okay, and it goes to the paper, the only thing I do is look to make sure it's in the, but I, because every time I look at a paragraph, I think, why did I say that?
Right.
Or you pick out a grammatical, and you think, oh, I should have caught that. Why did I catch that?
Yeah. So it's just a painful experience.
It's like looking at yourself in the mirror, unless you're a real, narcissist, it's kind of hard to, so I just check to see if it's there, maybe cut one out for my dad or something like that. And, but I don't like reading it. Once it goes to send, I don't like to look at it. I don't want to see it because then you start to beat yourself up over how you could have phrased it differently or why did I mention that or I thought I mentioned that.
Yeah, it's not a fun exercise.
No, proofreading is important. It's the most, it's a really important part of the end part of the writing process, but it's hard. And then once it's out there, you think, oh my God, somebody might read that and think,
you can't fix it anymore.
You can't fix it anymore. It's there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does writing energize or exhaust you?
I know I feel, once I hit send, I feel real good for 2 days.
Okay,
because you got, like, you kind of work yourself up, you do all the research. The hardest part to me of writing is sitting down and writing the first couple sentences, trying to come up with a hook. And once you've done that, then you kind of let it go. But I wouldn't say it's, it can be exhausting. I remember I wrote a chapter for the OSSTF history for their book about 5 years ago. That was exhausting. I had to get up and I had to pound out 20,000 words in a month. And it had like, and that was a really good exercise, but that was tiring, really, really tiring.
Right.
But on the other hand, you feel really good when it's done.
Right.
And so it's energizing that way because once it's done,
it's like success.
It's like success. That's right. Yeah. So you feel really good and you're energized and you feel, oh, well, it can't be that bad because they accepted it. I got, you know. But working up to it and then sitting down and writing your 1,000 words, and I only get 1,000 words, which a lot of people think is a lot, but it's not, because you have to edit out. And you got to be ruthless.
Yeah.
Because even though you think, oh, well, this is a pretty clever sentence, well, take it out because it doesn't fit with the rest of the thing. Maybe use it some other time, but so it can be exhausting, but I find mostly, or when somebody says, oh, I read your story and it was pretty good or whatever, that's energizing. Right. I think, okay, that's pretty good.
So it's both for you.
Yeah, well, it's got to be. I think it's like this up and down thing, like this, like working yourself up to actually having the discipline, sitting down and writing out. And that's the discipline thing again, and you kind of got to keep working on that discipline or whatever, and to sit down and write. But once it's, so that can be a bit exhausting, but you do feel good for 2 days after you send something to the paper. Thursday and Friday, I'm feeling really good, and Saturday, I'm thinking about the next one.
Right.
Yeah. starting, and then you start working up, and then it's kind of like this wave, this rhythm.
You keep going up. Yeah.
It's yeah.
Ride the wave, you go down.
Yeah.
I'm the same way. Because the discipline part, right?
Yeah.
And for me, like, I'm in the editing stage, and it's a bit, it can be tedious, right? Editing and making sure everything looks grammatically correct. And for me, that's not the fun part.
No, it's not. It certainly isn't. That's the hard part. In fact, sometimes, as you know, you spend more time editing than writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's all really, but it is worthwhile. If you really like, and there's nothing like, you know, I just said I didn't look at it in the paper. It's nothing like, you know, seeing like when you walk by a bookshelf and you see your name on a couple. I mean, let's face it, there is a bit of a narcissist that's kind of lurking there when you see, oh, well, that's me.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, don't say that too loud, but, you know, I mean, yeah. you'd be less than human if you didn't think that, oh, well, you know, it's...
Yeah, you feel good about that.
You feel good about that, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
For sure. If you could tell your younger writing self anything, what would it be?
Keep writing.
Yeah.
Don't, like I said, I went through this period where, well, I don't want to say it was discouraged, but I went through, see, I had really good teachers, but I remember we do creative writing, and I thought it was, the idea was to write about creatively, but then they'd say, well, you didn't stay on topic. Oh. And then you get all these kind of like that type of, but they were right, because they said, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't bad people or bad teachers. They were pretty good. But I thought the idea of creative writing, you take that and you kind of take it in this direction, but then they kind of... And so what I always tried to do when I was... If somebody was using imagination, okay, like when I was teaching, I thought, you know, I did... One of the things I learned from my own schooling is somebody's using imagination, don't rein it in by saying, here, put a limit on it, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, and I tell anybody, keep writing. Keep it something simple like a journal. Keep it once a week. Write like how your week went, and go back in 5 or 10 years, and keep go back and read it, and you'll see how much you changed or how much you haven't changed or whatever. Keep writing, keep reading, all that good stuff, and don't be afraid to. If you think you like writing, don't be afraid to chase that. You can do it anywhere, anytime. You don't need any special equipment, just a pen and paper or your laptop mm-hmm. or whatever. Do it.
Yeah.
Any time of the day, or like I said, I prefer to write at night. Some people get up early in the morning mm-hmm. and they find they're most productive then. I never found that, but some people do. I like to write, like, you know, well, at night, and I've even switched. It used to be when I was teaching, I would write on Friday and Saturday nights because mm-hmm. we didn't go to dances either. You know, yeah, so that's what, yeah. So you late Friday and Saturday night, and then, but since I've sort of semi-retired, I do it like Wednesday.
Okay.
You know, Wednesday night is when I kind of like, oh, but that means I got Friday and Saturday free again in case there's a dance.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but. But yeah, just keep writing, and everybody, and it's something everybody can do, even if you're not looking at publishing. I mean, I'd encourage anyone, like I said, I used to, not every club, but I used to tell, you know, start with writing a journal, just how your week was, a reflection on your week. Doesn't have to be long.
Right.
If you want to write a story on Spartans and that do it. Like, I mean, that sounds really, really interesting, and don't. Well, I think there's you're only limited, like that saying, you're only limited by your imagination, and just take the reins off and let it write about whatever you want to write about.
Right.
And if you think, well, this doesn't make sense, doesn't have to make sense. No. It just has to be what you think. Create a world of your own.
Right.
And you can do whatever you want in that imaginary world or whatever, and there's nothing wrong with it. Some of that stuff might be really good stuff. Someday.
Yeah.
And I find it really therapeutic, like almost cathartic sometimes, like you get to write and create something.
Right.
You know, and at the end of the day, you got something mm-hmm. that you did that, you know.
You accomplished or you created, yeah.
I mean, stuff you could, it goes out in the, it's somewhere forever.
Yep.
And, you know, so there's that kind of, even though, like, you don't get paid for writing in the paper or anything like that, right. But it's just something that you do for personal fulfillment, satisfaction. Yeah. Fulfillment's better, probably a better word.
Yeah. But yeah, let's talk about your researching process a bit. What kind of research do you do, and how long do you spend researching before beginning a book?
Or you might tweak that question. With those stories, sometimes it takes, you get an idea for a story, and it might take a couple years before it percolates. You have to kind of be in the mood to write on a certain topic. Other times, you get somebody to give you an idea for a story. You could research it and do it in maybe as little as 2 or 3 or 4 days. But I like to take more time, and I, as much as possible, I like to look at the primary sources first before I go to the secondary sources. And part of the reason why I do that is if somebody's already done, or you find out that somebody's already done something on it, I want to get away from that. I don't want to look at that. So that people say, well, you just copied him. So you want to go back as much as possible. I like dealing with the newspapers and letters or interviews. Mm-hmm. If you talk to somebody and they, like, those are, to me, far more interesting. And you get extract more information that way. And then if I have to, I go back and look at a secondary source. But I usually like to do that when I'm almost done all the research and I know I kind of formulated how I want it organized and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I might check out if there's a fact that I think, or they might have something, but normally I try to rely as much as possible on primary research. And I have to say, once again, the digitized newspaper archives online are tremendous. They're great. I mean, because you could not do a weekly local history call, at least for as long, without access in your home to something like that. Mm-hmm. And it beats when you used to have to scroll through all those old newspapers, order them from the library. The library was always great because you get them in a couple of days, microfilm. Mm-hmm. But when you have them online, and so much stuff is online now, you can go to the library and archives online, and I found so much stuff that's available from them on local history too. Like, I mean, you can go back and that's my favorite part, is thinking that you're writing about something that nobody has written about for a long time or since that. So those are pretty satisfying to do. And as I said, as much as possible, rely on the primary research. And then what I do, this is just me, just so I get some idea of the story, I've been, for the last 5 or 6 years, transcribing the newspaper articles, like typing them directly, not even downloading and printing them off the articles. I like to type them out, because what that does, as I'm typing, I'm getting a sense of the story.
Right.
Okay, it's kind of getting in, working its way in, and how it develops. And then when you run those pages off, we talked about, there was one guy, Mr. Robert James Scott, and the co-op movement did over 50 pages. I transcribed several hundred articles. And by the time you read it, and so you're going through all this stuff, and then after you read it through, you see how the story kind of develops. And so doing that, that's labor intensive. Like, if you don't like typing,
right,
or processing or inputting, you're not. But I don't mind doing that. There's almost kind of like a, I don't know. It just kind of feels okay to read the newspaper article and type it out, and then I've got my own. The story is right there. I just have to boil it down into 1,000 words,
right,
which can be hard, especially if it's something you could write on. It's a lot easier to write a 2,000-word story than it is a 1,000-word story.
Especially when you got 50 pages to...
Yeah, and you got to boil that down to just from, you know, birth to death, you got to boil that down to 1,000 words.
Yeah, that can't be easy.
You know, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's pretty obvious what belongs on the cutting room floor.
Right.
You know? And so when I'm doing and I really like doing the primary research. Sometimes I've gone to Western, like we talked about, going to the archives there. The museum here is always very helpful. Mm-hmm. And as it firsthand accounts or primary sources, I much prefer those than grabbing a couple books off the shelf and trying to rehash what somebody else has written.
Right.
Yeah. So that's my research method for now.
And so the books, just to make sure I'm clear, they're from your article. Like you take articles you've already written, and they have been put into the books.
Collated into, yeah.
Yeah.
But, and then they get edited down so that I'm not repeating myself and
right.
Or updated, because new information comes and you got to change stuff so that you hope. And every time I get the books run off from the print shop, there's usually changes so that I can almost tell now if I'm reading like the first wave of books that came out compared to one the later one, because I kind of look for key things if somebody asks me to sign something. And I go, oh, this is one of the later books. That's one of the first ones and all that stuff. But you're always kind of, and that's one of the neat things about the word processor and the printing process now, is that you can make, most people call them corrections, but let's say updates.
Right.
Yeah, we can update them now, you know, yeah. You know, so that they're more accurate and up to date.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely a helpful thing, because before, I feel like if you put your book out there and saw something that wasn't right, there's nothing you could do about it. It was out there and it's too late now, kind of thing.
Well, I was just reading about J.R.R. Tolkien. And in the first American edition of The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings? The Hobbit, yeah. When the American edition came out, he had all these changes he wanted to make, but they were in such a hurry to get it out because it was such a bestseller in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But now people are fighting to get that first edition that without the corrections, without the changes that he made, because I guess they're significantly different versions, and some people actually prefer. I was just reading about this today. Some people actually prefer his original version. The original American, and they weren't as enamored with his changes. Like, he made significant changes, I guess. So I don't have anything to compare that to, but because I haven't read both. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah. As I said, I just read that today, and I thought that was really interesting. But you could do that today. Changes would be so much easier to make.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Today.
The way it's set up, such technology. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can do it fairly quickly now.
Yeah.
You know, as you say, updated copies.
Right? Yeah, updated copies. Yeah, yeah, updates. Yeah. Yeah.
What are the ethics of writing about historical figures? I guess we touched on that already, didn't we?
Yeah, I try as much as possible, even if I don't agree or like the person, you try to give them a fair hearing. Mm-hmm. And not, this is where you got to kind of hide yourself sometimes, especially if you're writing history. Mm-hmm. And instead of, you got to be fair. Like, I always kind of think when you're writing out people from the past that you got to be fair to them. Mm-hmm. I make the assumption that most, not everybody, but most people are trying to do the best job that they can with the information and the values that they have at the time. And so what I try to do is explain why they thought the way they did. Not apologize, but explain why they thought the way they did. And why what they thought might make sense for somebody. Like, I go back to that D.H. Lawrence quote, if he said it, about the past is a different country. And you have to be fair to people in the past. And that's one of the things that in the last, I'd say, 20 years, a lot of nonfiction boils down to hardcore. Like, people impose their ideology or condemn people based on a modern 21st century sensibility. Mm-hmm. On people living in the 19th century, and I don't think that's fair to them, and I don't think that's accurate, sometimes not an accurate view of history. Mm-hmm. And so that would be one thing that I really try to do. And as I said, even if I don't like the person or I don't agree, or you try to present their idea the way that they would have saw it, and try to explain, maybe if it sounds, explain why somebody at that particular point in time might think the way they did. That's far more interesting than these black and white images of people that we start to, like, to me, it's like, writing nonfiction now, for a while it was really good in the 90s, and I'd say up until about 15 years ago, but it seems to be really ideologically driven now. And I'm not a favor of any ideology driving. Like, I kind of like to think, like, I want, like, a free, I probably not. People would say no, and it's true, but as much as possible, like when we were in class and we'd have debates, I'd always try to be the devil's advocate, even though I didn't agree with sometimes a lot of the things I said. I try to stir things up just to say, okay, this is how, because you always want people to be, feel that they could speak out in your, or whatever, on a topic, even though they, because I used to, see, I was in school, one of the things I didn't like is when the teacher would say, okay, you'd have a debate, and then the teacher would give you, somebody would say, what do you think? And then they give you, so guess what? You read that 30 times in the test, because everyone knows you want to get a good mark, you got to think, but, well, I never wanted to do that, because I wanted people to kind of come up with their own conclusions, and you'd try to be fair to everybody, nice. even though that you don't agree with it, but you have to be fair with presenting, I think, both sides or multiple sides of an issue fairly. So let people come up with, they feel that, you know, and I can go either way, because I'd rather have that than somebody imposing their opinion. This is what I think. And so this is kind of what I want. Even though we've had this great discussion, this is what I want to read on the test.
Nice.
You know?
Yeah.
So when people would ask me in class, well, what do you think? I'd say, can you keep a secret? Well, so can I. Because you never want to tell people, whether it's the death penalty, communism versus capitalism, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay? I'm not going to tell you how to think. Here are some viewpoints that you can go look up and read and do it on your own. I'd encourage that. But you come up with your own conclusion.
Which, I mean, maybe it's bigger than that, but that's like, it's the cornerstone of democracy, right? That's what democracy is about. Is it how you can have your own ideas. At least that's not all democracy is about, but that's part of it.
But airing different ideas, that's right. Mm-hmm. That we don't all have to think in a certain way or in lockstep, that we all have different ideas. And that's where creativity comes from. It's from people kind of like challenging, mm-hmm. having the freedom to challenge norms. And that's how we kind of, I think, progress. Not every idea is a good one or valid or anything like that, but there's enough of them out there that become part of the grain or that help us progress. And that's, and whether it's ideas, philosophy, or technology, or politics, mm-hmm. that's how we progress, is if we allow people to come up with unique ways of thinking. And as John Ford said, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. That's the other thing I noticed about reading, like, about local history, one, or any history, mm-hmm. is you can never win an argument. If somebody says, my grandfather or grandmother, whoever said this, even what, like, I mean, it's amazing how people would rather believe legends than the facts. Like, I mean, that clearly did or didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And people would rather believe in the legend. A lot of people. The legend, even though the legend might not be as interesting, the legend is more important.
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. Yeah. And I can think of a couple examples, but I won't. But for a lot of people, the legend is far more, has become the fact for them, right?
I wonder, yeah. It's a strange phenomenon.
Yeah, I guess. And there's probably something in human nature that likes the legend better. The legend is more appealing than what actually happened. Even though what actually happened isn't terrible or right. not, yeah.
It's interesting or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
One more question.
Okay.
How long on average does it take from like start to finish to write a book, to finish one of your books?
The Bayfield book comes closest to like the traditional.
Because you didn't have previous articles you were plugging into that book?
No, I didn't know.
You were
no.
doing new research, new
yeah stories. That was like more the traditional structure of a book with chapters, and that's nice. I think I wrote one article 1,000 words on Bayfield, but that was a very small mm-hmm. you know.
So how long, I guess, did that book take?
See, that one's because that got derailed by the pandemic. But I would say from start to finish, taking away the pandemic gaps, I'm going to guess 10 to 12 months.
Okay.
Yeah. To do the to do the research and put cobble everything together.
Yeah.
And then start writing it. The writing process took me about 6 weeks to actually write it. 6-8 weeks to actually write it. It probably took about 8-10 months of research. There was a time you couldn't go to the libraries, right? And you couldn't go to you couldn't contact anybody at Library and Archives Canada. You
probably couldn't come here either.
No, you couldn't come here. I don't think that you got anything on.
We were all closed.
Yeah. So I wouldn't have been able to use this. So that kind of got interrupted by the pandemic, like so much did, which is why that anything online was so great.
Right. Because we had some newspapers digitized.
Oh, you had a lot of them digitized.
There were already a lot of them digitized when the pandemic hit, right?
Yeah, so you could do a lot of work from. So that was really useful. Yeah,
that was, especially at that time, would have been really valuable.
Yeah, because we had almost 2 years of disruption, like on and off disruptions or limited service.
Yeah, lockdowns and all that.
Yeah. So that's another challenge, writing during a pandemic. But actually, it's, was okay.
Well, it gave you something to do.
That's right. It gave, something to do other than, sitting in the basement or the backyard, right?
Right.
Yeah, so it was good. It wasn't terrible.
No.
And, it's kind of sad that when a lockdown and a pandemic doesn't really disrupt your social life too much.
That's, I'd say that's a little bit sad.
Yeah. So it didn't really, didn't have that big an impact.
Right.
Yeah, I guess when you look back,
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Huron County Author Talk with your host, Hamilton Baker. I hope you enjoyed my chat with David as much as I did. If you'd like to purchase one of his books, you can find them at local bookstores, including Finchers in Goderich, the Bayfield Village Bookshop, and the Blythe Citizen. You can also borrow all 5 of his books from the library. Visit HuronCountyLibrary.ca to place a hold today. Stay tuned for our next episode that will release in 2 weeks. The music on this program is Echo by Alan McKellis. Thanks for listening.